everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible for your health and well-being. And as always, it's such a pleasure to have you join me today. If you are listening for the first time, I want to welcome you and also invite you to go to my website, which is drcherylselman.com, because I deliver the shows right into your inbox. And in fact, I have two programs on PRN, and both of them will get delivered right to you. So you just have to go to Dr. Cheryl Selman, and Cheryl is spelled S-H-E-R-R-I-L-L, Selman, two L's, .com. And you can also go to What Women Must Know, which is my Facebook page, because I post all the shows there along with other information. So always check in on both those places to keep yourself up to date with the latest knowledge, wisdom, and practical strategies to ensure a healthy lifestyle and healthy living. And we're going to be talking about a healthy lifestyle and healthy living today, because we're going to be talking about the urgent threat of hormone-disrupting chemicals to our health and our future, and what to do about it, with my very special guest today, Dr. Leonardo Trescend. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about my guest. He is an internationally renowned leader in children's environmental health and a tenured associate professor in pediatrics, environmental medicine, and population health at New York University. He has appeared on Today Show, CNN, PRN, CBS News, and been featured in the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Reuters, National Geographic, USA Today, and dozens of other media outlets. He lives in New York City with his family, and he is the author of the latest book called Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future, and What We Can Do About It. This is a really important topic. I have researched it. I have lectured about it. I have written about it. And it's time that we really spread the word and become aware of what's going on regarding the exposure to hormone-disrupting chemicals, the health of ourselves, our children, and future generations. So first of all, let me welcome my guest, Dr. Leonardo Trescend. Thank you. And have I pronounced your surname correctly?
Trescende, but thank you for having me.
Trescende. I'm so sorry. So, Dr. Trescende, thank you for being with us. You're pretty passionate about this subject. You are working not only in medicine, pediatrics, but helping to create environmental policies. And I really respect your passion and your purpose in life. So I just want to thank you and acknowledge you for the great work you're doing. Let's start by, the first question I have is, what got you interested in this issue of hormone-disrupting chemicals and just environmental pollutants in general on our health and well-being?
So I came into the world of environmental exposures and their impact on human health from the lens of health policy. I trained as a medical student in the early 90s when during my interviews I was asked for my perspective about the Clinton health care plan. And at one point I had to stop an interviewer and simply say, well, what education do I get about health policy in the medical curriculum? I'm not sure that interview went over so well, but it spoke to recognition that we have a lot of influence on the policymaking process as doctors, and that is, it's important to understand the influence of legislation and regulation on people's lives. And so I decided to get a master's in public policy with my medical degree between my third and my fourth year of training. And that year at the Kennedy School of Government was really transformative in my thinking about policy and its impact on people's lives. And I, if you will, caught capital fever and decided to get some more training after my pediatric residency. And spent a year on Capitol Hill working for then-Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, where I was told to work on children's and environmental health policy. And I figured I had the child health policy part figured out, but didn't really think going in that much or too much about or too deeply about the effect of the environment on people's lives, but realized after a very brief time working on the Hill how much impact the environment had on people's lives in so many different ways. And so my mindset, my whole career path was transformed by that experience. And I decided to get some additional environmental health policy training, working first at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and eventually embarked on a career looking at the impact of environment on people's lives. There's a lot we can do with prescriptions and with treatments for conditions, but there's a lot even more profound we can do, not just one patient at a time, but hundreds and thousands of patients at a time through proactively intervening to address environmental factors that are contributing to disease and also making disease worse.
So are you inspired by the changes that are happening, or are you frustrated by what you see?
I'm quite optimistic. We've seen so much progress in our understanding, for example, of chemicals and their impact on the hormones in our body. So just to go to Hormones 101, if you will, or Endocrinology 101, hormones are the basic signaling molecules our body uses to maintain healthy body temperature, metabolism, salt, sugar, and even sex. And synthetic chemicals that disrupt hormonal signaling are endocrine disruptors and thereby contribute to disease. They scramble those hormonal signals, ultimately, even through low-level exposures, can scramble basic hormonal signals, leading to disruption in how organs signal to each other. And we used to think these were once-offs or very high levels of exposure. The prototype chemical back in the 1940s and 50s that we think about when we think about endocrine disruption is a pharmaceutical called diethylstilbestrol, which was given to pregnant women to prevent symptoms of pregnancy and miscarriage. But it was recognized some decades later that young girls exposed to that diethylstilbestrol in utero developed rare cancers that had not been previously seen. And it was that recognition that led to the pharmaceutical being phased out. But that, again, was thought to just simply be something that happened when drugs went wrong or at very high levels of exposure. Now we know of over 1,000 synthetic chemicals that can scramble hormonal signals and thereby contribute to disease. And we know these chemicals can do that at very low levels of exposures. The evidence is particularly strong for four groups of synthetic chemicals: the flame retardants that are used in electronics, furniture, and even carpeting, pesticides, which are used in agriculture, bisphenols, which are used in thermal paper receipts, as well as aluminum can linings, and phthalates, which are used in consumer products, food packaging, and cosmetics.
So, you know, I remember when I was researching and writing this about DES, diethylstilbestrol, that not only did it create huge problems in women hormonally and cancers, but it affected down to three generations, and we don't know if a fourth generation is affected. So it's a really big story here as far as hormone disruption. And also I also started interviewing lots of families that had girls and boys with precocious puberty, and linking in exposure to these hormone-disrupting chemicals as one of the critical factors that were altering the hormonal signaling in young children. And do you want to just add a little bit to that and kind of get me up to speed what's happening these days with that awareness?
So diethylstilbestrol, as you described, has been identified to have consequences not just in the children of exposed mothers, but in the great-grandchildren of exposed mothers. And the way that that appears to occur is that diethylstilbestrol induces changes in the way genes are expressed, not by changing the genome itself, not by changing the AGCT code, but by changing signaling on the genes through various subtle changes that can produce increases in expression or decreases in expression. And those signals get passed along from generation to generation and can induce effects that go beyond simply the children having consequences. It can be those grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. And that's not documented just for diethylstilbestrol. That's been documented for bisphenol A, which is used in the linings of aluminum cans and thermal paper receipts, as well as a host of synthetic chemicals. And that really rose to attention, not just due to synthetic chemical exposures, but these are epigenetics is what we call this entire scientific field. And we know that changes in diet, physical activity, tobacco smoke, not just synthetic chemicals, can induce similar changes.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about bisphenol A. That's something people may know something about because it's found in plastics such as our water bottles, and it's found, as you were saying, the lining of tin cans, and it's found in dental sealants. I think they're still doing it, I'm not sure, but it's also found in receipts. And many people do not understand that the we'll talk a little bit about the concerns and risks about bisphenol A, but I don't think people understand that when they get those receipts, that bisphenol A is a chemical used in the heat-sensitive receipts, so you can see the printing that comes out. By handling that, and just think about all the people who are, you know, at department stores, at food stores. I mean, every store that gives out a receipt is handling this paper that has bisphenol A getting into their bodies, as well as the customers. This is a really big problem, isn't it? And it's so ubiquitous in how we're being exposed to bisphenol A, even if you don't want to use plastic water bottles.
Well, first of all, it's important to emphasize that the types of chemicals that you are used in this lining are not just BPA or bisphenol A. There are 40 or so bisphenols now used in a variety of consumer care products, and they came into use more and more as people started to put more attention on BPA. And perhaps in response to customer enthusiasm and awareness about BPA, we had what I might describe as chemical whack-a-mole happen, where BPA was replaced with BPS, BPF, BPAP, a host of synthetic chemicals that may be as estrogenic, as persistent in the environment, and even as toxic to embryos. So we've literally traded one problem out for the other and undermined the potential benefits of the attention that should have been given to change. And that's because the regulatory framework for a long time has assumed that replacement chemicals are innocent until proverbially guilty. That is, that you replace one chemical with another, and the presumption is that the chemical is safe for widespread use, but the chemicals were not tested for their impacts on hormonal functions in our body. And that last problem is partly a product of the lack of science that we have about our scientific understanding that these chemicals can scramble hormonal signals and contribute to disease.
You know, it's so amazing that all these chemicals are rolled out and they're proven innocent until proven guilty, which may take decades and decades and tremendous amount of harm before finally, probably with great effort and persuasion, is acknowledged that they are contributing to harm. It just boggles my mind that that we have acquiesced to chemical companies to such a degree that we have this ruling. So I just have to say it's shocking.
For synthetic chemicals in products under the Environmental Protection Agency, something has changed. The Toxic Substances Control Act was recently changed to require at least some degree of data before chemicals are used on a widespread basis. So there's been some progress. The problem is that the Environmental Protection Agency isn't the only place that has oversight in the federal government when it comes to synthetic chemicals. The Food and Drug Administration, as well as other agencies, have a role. And so it's more of a Swiss cheese framework. And these other agencies don't have the same understanding. Many chemicals, for example, under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act can be simply vouched for by the industry as generally recognized as safe. And so as a result of that, we have a situation where many chemicals are presumed, as you say, innocent, and then have to be proven guilty through science and studies of humans who are undergoing what I might describe as a dangerous and unnatural experiment.
Right. So let's talk about some of the other effects from hormone-disrupting chemicals, because we mentioned that it does have an effect on our hormones. It can contribute to things such as precocious puberty. I think 1 out of 6 8-year-olds are showing signs of puberty, which really shocked me when I first learned about that. It may be worse now, because that's when I did my research about 20 years ago and I wrote my book. So has that statistic changed, or is it about the same that are you aware of?
Well, it's tough to follow these trends because they're not national surveys that have regularly documented that, but suffice it to say that we know that synthetic chemicals can accelerate or decelerate various aspects of puberty. And the concern about early puberty, especially in girls, is that it's an especially increased risk of breast cancer.
Yes, you know, I met girls who had early onset of their puberty, I mean 7-8 years of age, and they had all sorts of hormonal issues, including endometriosis, ovarian cysts, infertility issues, as well as, you said, increased risk of breast cancer. But there are other hormone types of hormone disruption that goes on when we have exposure to these chemicals. Can you elaborate on some of the other manifestations of hormone disrupting chemicals?
Sure. So the science has especially accelerated over the past 2 decades to suggest that chemicals can literally make us fatter. So going back to the example of BPA, BPA literally makes fat cells bigger. It disrupts the function of a protein that protects the heart lining called adiponectin. And it's a synthetic estrogen, and so can have sex-specific effects on body mass. In addition, we know that chemicals can literally scramble how the body responds by burning energy. It can literally slow the thermostat, if you will. And a particular category of chemicals that raises this concern are the perfluoralkyl substances, the Teflon-like compounds that have gotten attention because they are found as contaminants in water of late. And the reason why these chemicals are of concern is a study found that after a weight loss intervention that had successfully decreased weight through healthy diet and physical activity, that the levels of perfluoralkyl substances predicted the weight regain, especially among women. And what they found as the reason behind that weight regain was that the body's metabolic rate had slowed down substantially in relationship to these chemicals. So it literally had slowed the burn rate of the human body, leading to calorie retention and ultimately weight gain.
So are they affecting things like the hypothalamus? Are they affecting the thyroid? Are they affecting leptin levels? What is causing that slowdown of metabolism?
We still need to unravel the understanding behind the slowdown in the metabolic rate, in the resting metabolic rate. It's probably a byproduct of multiple factors, but one factor in particular is a group of receptors in the body called PPAR. It's a complicated name, peroxisome proliferator activated receptors, but without getting into jargon, they're the master regulators of how our body processes calories into sugar and fat.
So we can say that the exposure to hormone-disrupting chemicals has contributed to the obesity epidemic that we are seeing now.
I'm not saying the entirety of the obesity and diabetes epidemic are due to synthetic chemicals. Far from it. Physical activity and unhealthy diet are still the leading drivers of that epidemic. But in contrast to maintaining a healthy physical activity and dietary lifestyle, which can be difficult, changes in manufacturing processes can be relatively straightforward and not pose a substantial economic burden to companies. And those can be rapidly instituted, producing benefits insofar as these chemicals disrupt metabolism.
So are there any other studies that are looking at further consequences of exposure to these hormone-disrupting chemicals in addition to hormonal imbalances and impaired metabolic function? Anything else that is now showing up as being affected from exposure?
Many of these studies remain in progress, but what little we know about the plasticizing chemicals, phthalates, are that they similarly disrupt this category of receptors I talked about, potentially leading to increased shifts of normal calorie loads into carbohydrates and fat rather than to protein.
Well, okay, so we know we live in a sea of chemicals. We have exposures, but you know, your book is talking about strategies that we can institute to reduce exposure. And I just got an email this morning that was actually inspiring, I guess you might say, because it was looking at a study. You may have heard of this study from the Swedish Environmental Research Institute that came out that found that when people, they worked with people who ate a diet that was just right out of the supermarket. So it was commercialized food, you might say. And they looked at the toxic exposure in their body, which is really, really high. And then they had several weeks where they just ate organic. So that was their primary source of food, all organic. And they found that the amount of pesticide in their urine was reduced by 6.7 times when they switched from conventional to organic. That's pretty stunning and actually uplifting to think about, that with some of these chemicals, we can so rapidly reduce exposure in our body.
Well, the reality is that studies have documented just that in the U.S. in low and high income populations, speaking to the feasibility of changing to organic consumption. I'm not saying it's as if the prices of organic and conventional foods are the same right now, but what we know now is that the market share for organic food has substantially increased. We've seen double-digit gains as a percentage in market share over each year for organic food, such that big box stores are taking this on and increasingly selling organic food options side by side. And especially for those leafy greens and vegetables where the outer layer tends to carry the highest amount of pesticide that goes directly into the body, that's where you get the biggest bang for the proverbial buck. Picking organic. Environmental Working Group also has a list of Dirty Dozen in which they document the fruits and vegetables that tend to have the highest levels of pesticides detected.
And, I know that places like Walmart and such are bringing in more organic food, which is great. And so many people say that it's more expensive to buy organic food, but there have been studies shown that if you choose healthy foods over a lot of the conventional box stuff, processed stuff, it actually isn't any more expensive. It's just a matter of realizing that one choice is going to support your health and the other is going to contribute to your downward spiral of health. So people need to appreciate how important it is. I think the fact that, this study, and I know there have been other studies done, that organic food makes a big difference in toxic exposure in your body. So it becomes imperative to make those choices. So I would like to ask you, what other either lifestyle factors or nutritional factors do you think are imperative for people to start implementing to reduce toxic exposure to these hormone-disrupting chemicals?
The great news is that there are safe and simple steps we can all take to reduce exposures to the chemicals of greatest concern. We've already talked about pesticides. For bisphenol, saying no to that thermal paper receipt and taking an electronic receipt instead is a great and straightforward way to reduce your bisphenol exposure. Also, avoiding canned food consumption is a great way to reduce dietary exposure to bisphenols. These bisphenols don't discriminate whether the can has beans, vegetables, fruits, tuna, or soda, or beer. They all
or coconut or coconut milk too. I mean, coconut milk is really popular, but that's mostly found in cans as well.
So in addition to reducing your exposure to bisphenols, let's talk about phthalates and chemicals used in plastic. So there's a recycling number on the bottom of a plastic bottle, and it ranges from 1 to 7. The numbers 3, 6, and 7 are the ones to avoid across the board. 3 is for phthalates, which can also disrupt the male sex hormone, testosterone, in addition to disrupting metabolism and potentially contributing to obesity and diabetes, as they've been found to in adult women. 6 is for styrene, a known carcinogen. And 7 is for those bisphenols that we already talked about. There's been a lot of effort to put plant-based plastics into that number 7 category, but unfortunately you can't distinguish the plant-based plastics from the bisphenol-containing plastics with the number 7 on them. In addition, avoiding microwaving plastic is important because you may think that microwave-safe plastic is free of this kind of resorption, but the reality is that's only definitively ruling out any macroscopic or large-scale warping or misshaping of the plastic. At a subtle microscopic level, the chemicals in the plastic leach into food and ultimately into our bodies. In addition, avoiding machine dishwashing plastic containers is important because that can, the harsh temperatures and the harsh chemicals can erode the plastic, leading to greater resorption. And if it's obviously etched or scratched, it's time to throw it away.
Well, is that for all types of plastic containers, or do we need to look at those numbers? Are there any safe plastic containers that we can use or we can have in our dishwasher?
I suggest not machine dishwashing or microwaving plastic containers across the board.
At all. Okay. What about water filters?
Again, it's better to wash with hand soap and control the temperature of the water that's being used to wash it out. It's not as if it takes a huge amount of extra effort to take that step.
No, I mean, I was referring to people having water filters for their drinking water, for their showers. Is that part of a strategy that would help?
The water filters can be helpful for metals. They're not as good for the synthetic chemicals that we're talking about here, the organic chemicals. They're not designed to remove as readily those materials.
Oh, right. Okay. So it's always good to have a filter, but not necessarily filtering out the hormone-disrupting chemicals. It's other forms of pesticides and chemicals that are in the water system. That's good to know. I didn't know that. When do you think people are most vulnerable to exposure? Do you think that pregnant women and fetus is the most vulnerable to these hormone-disrupting chemicals that we're talking about, or is it equally dangerous to us at any age?
The evidence is greatest for the effects of these chemicals on pregnant women and children, but there are effects that are important for all of us. I know this program isn't about guys, but in particular, there are increasing concerns about disruption of the male sex hormone, which is important in the context that sperm counts have declined 40 to 50% over the past 3 decades. But these testosterone in particular is important for potency, and we know that 40% of men over the age of 40 have some degree of impotence. And what little we know, largely from worker-based studies, suggests that chemicals can disrupt potency, and perhaps through testosterone or through other pathways. In addition, we know that synthetic chemicals have been associated with conditions as diverse as fibroids or endometriosis, which are painful and disabling conditions in some cases. We know that bisphenol A is toxic to the embryo, contributing to a host of effects. And these are consequences that can emerge not only in childhood, but also in adulthood and later life as well.
So we all really need to be aware that exposure to the chemicals we've been talking about, bisphenol A and phthalates, are disrupting the functioning of our physiology at all ages, but especially all women who are and men who are considering having children, getting pregnant. And certainly when you are pregnant, you have to be incredibly vigilant to make sure that you're reducing exposure to these hormone-disrupting chemicals.
Again, the good news here is that there you don't need a PhD in chemistry to reduce exposure to the chemicals of greatest concern. So avoiding canned food consumption, watching microwaving or plastic containers, avoiding it altogether, saying no to the thermal paper receipt, eating organic, also simply recirculating the air to get rid of flame retardants and other persistent organic pollutant exposures that can linger in dust in the home. These are all generally straightforward steps that don't necessarily have to break the bank. Yes, there are some differences between organic and conventional foods price-wise, but they're priority fruits and vegetables where you can invest proactively in eating organic and get the greatest bang for the proverbial buck.
Yeah. Do you think hormone-disrupting chemicals are also playing a role in cardiovascular disease, in the increase of Alzheimer's? I'm sure they're already implicated with diabetes. What are your thoughts about these other health or chronic health conditions?
There are studies that document bisphenols as contributors to cardiovascular risk. That is based upon studies that have not only looked at the diagnoses of cardiovascular disease, but is at measurements of the coronary arteries and narrowing of the coronary arteries in relationship to exposure to bisphenols. In addition, phthalates are associated with reductions in testosterone, and we talk about low T or low testosterone being a lifestyle matter to some extent, but it's also literally a life and death matter. Low T is either a marker for or a predictor of adult cardiovascular disease, and given that low T has been associated with adult cardiovascular events as well as stroke, it can literally contribute to mortality. And insofar as phthalates contribute to reductions in testosterone, they can also be associated with this preventable and serious series of events.
You know, I think that this is such an important message. It's affecting really all of us at all ages. I think the fetus and perhaps infants are more vulnerable because, as you said, it can alter signaling that can affect how they develop, when they go into puberty, how they developed, sexually, which may not be reversible. When they're very young. I mean, that's my thought. Maybe I should ask you that question. If there is early exposure, is it reversible in children who've been exposed in the womb or very early in life?
It's long been known that you can't recreate a child's brain development, but the brain is not the only organ system that is susceptible to injury and narrow windows of development that can produce permanent and lifelong consequences. The endocrine system is also a major system that can have fundamental changes in programming occur early or later in life that then can produce permanent and lifelong consequences that span for many years beyond. The good news at the same time, though, is that many of these chemical exposures can be modified with changes that occur in the short, medium, and long term. So let's say you get rid of phthalates in fragrances or in lotions that you buy, you might see a decrease in your phthalate levels in days. You might see changes in your hormones in weeks. And then you might see changes in your risk for chronic disease in the months that follow. So there are short, medium, and long-term gains for proactively preventing.
Which is really important. Well, I think that, it's important to understand that you really want to clean up your toxic load before you get pregnant for both men and women, which I think you've really made that clear for people. That's the exposure, exposure to these chemicals in utero could have lifelong consequences. Fortunately, if we have exposure when we're older, we can help to detoxify our body and reduce exposure and hopefully reduce some of the effects that exposure is having on our body if we choose to get healthy, if we choose to do the things you suggested, you know, a good water filter, maybe air purifier, choosing to organic, get rid of all your commercial personal care products, anything that's not organic is going to have chemicals that are disrupting in some degree or other. Is there anything else that we haven't touched on yet that people need to be aware of or changes people can make to reduce their exposure?
No, we've talked about things people can do in their homes, but these are exposures in our schools, our workplaces, our buses, our subways. And we spend a lot of time outside the home. 8 or more hours a day, each day at work. If you're working and then perhaps going out on weekends and weekdays in the evening. And so there are many other environments that we can modify. And we've seen that a little action by a major manufacturer can go a long way. We've seen school systems modify their cleaning materials such that they've gotten rid of chemicals of concern. And that can multiply the force that each of us has with our own pocketbook or wallet, if you will. And that can really be a huge force multiplier. Very recently, we saw two major supermarket chains get rid of these perfluoroalkyl substances in their buffet-style food packaging. And you literally saw on Instagram and Facebook companies setting these food packages aside and insisting on their upstream provider to change their manufacturing practices. And that's a huge force multiplier. And you've seen now through similar consumer campaigns decreases in the population levels of phthalates and bisphenols by a third or even more over the past decade alone. So I have a lot of optimism here. We've made a lot of progress, and that progress is not only reducing disease and disability, but reducing costs to society. All too often I hear the argument, well, it's too costly to substitute out these exposures. But the reality is that diseases due to endocrine-disrupting chemicals cost the U.S. $340 billion, that's billion with a B, each year. That's 2.3% of our gross domestic product, and we lose that. That's like a $1,000 tax on each of us every year insofar as exposures continue at current levels.
Yeah, you know, it certainly takes its toll on our health, as we were saying, through all stages of life. So are you involved at this point in time with policymaking with the government?
We advise policymakers in Europe and the United States all the time, sometimes with various levels of impact, depending upon the context. But, yes, there's a role for policy. But in addition, we've seen so much progress that we can make through consumer action. Just look at what happened when California changed its requirement such that you no longer had to add flame retardant to meet a flammability standard in furniture. You saw major companies, major furniture sellers, being asked to get rid of all their flame retardant containing material. And not only did they have to already document that on the label anyway, but you saw major manufacturers realizing that consumers care about these issues. So as much as I appreciate policymakers can have a big impact, sometimes it's actually consumer activism that starts the domino effect. If you look at BPA-free, that didn't happen necessarily because of science. That happened because of consumer attention and media attention, quite frankly, to BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups. And the companies got word, they changed their manufacturing practices, and they ran to the FDA insisting on a ban of BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups. And so that speaks to the power of the consumer in being the change that we seek.
Well, that is inspiring. So what organizations do you recommend people support, or what are the ways that people can get more consumer action going in their lives?
Well, I've got a website with a lot more information and videos to provide safe and simple steps for people to take to limit their exposure. It's sickerfatterpoorer.com or leotrasande, that's TRASANDE.com.
So that would be the first step, to go to sickerfatterpoorer.com, which is, and I'll list both of those websites when we send out the archives, for more education, to be able to understand more of what's going on and then to be able to take more action. Do you think that, you know, like supermarket workers, anyone who's at a cash register, do you think that they should have or be educated with warnings that handing out these receipts every day is a risk and they should be wearing gloves or, you know, something for protection? Do you think that is an issue that needs to be addressed?
Well, we're seeing a lot of progress already where these receipts are not being generated in the first place. There's even a viral video about this called bpa-free.me. And that speaks to the exposures that occur for the person who's providing the receipt as well as the person who's receiving the receipt. There are studies ongoing that suggest as well that hand sanitizer can greatly facilitate the absorption of these bisphenols ultimately through our skin and ultimately in our bodies, not to mention the hand-to-mouth behavior that we're all used to doing.
So you're saying the hand sanitizers will increase exposure of these chemicals into the body?
There's a study that has identified that.
Well, you know, those hand sanitizers are always at the checkout counter, right? You know, oh gosh, I'm so glad we're having this conversation because these are things that not enough people understand. There's not enough awareness, and just in the situation we're talking about with anyone dealing at a cash register, that, you know, this is important information that people need to have because it has such wide-ranging effects. So, you know, these conversations are so important, and I just so appreciate what you're doing and trying to spread the word, enlighten people, get the information out. It really does make a difference by reducing exposure and by following some simple strategies, making simple changes, just like that Swedish study I just quoted, you know, just, you know, several weeks of going on organic food reduced their toxic load of many chemicals by 6.7 times. That's huge. So that's the good news, isn't it, that we can actually reduce our toxic exposure by making some simple changes. Is there anything else you want to add before we, I know you have to go, before we wrap up the show, Dr. Trasande, that we didn't cover?
The reality here is that these cost us all, and the economic benefits of doing the right thing often outweigh the costs. We did a study looking at BPA, which is still not banned in aluminum cans, by the way, and I did a hypothetical. We said, what if you replace it with a chemical free of the consequences? And there actually is one, at least, that's been suggested as such, called oleoresin. It's 2.2 cents on the can. It would cost $2.2 billion to replace each year. And we did a study looking at just two of the health consequences associated with BPA, childhood obesity and adult cardiovascular risks. And the benefits, even on that conservative a subset, of the potential benefits associated with getting BPA out of people's bodies suggested economic benefits on the order of $1.7 billion. So there really is a business case for reducing these exposures, and we can all win through these proactive steps. But it takes us all having that conversation and initiating it that can produce moving the needle on this issue in a profound way. I'd like to say that it's 1% of the public that knows about these issues, yet 99% are affected. And if we can move that needle and change it even from 1% to 2%, we'll have started a domino effect towards really changing how people expose themselves in their daily lives.
And that's a really inspirational note to end our conversation. I know that's really the passion that I have, and having guests like you and experts in your field are helping people to understand the need to make changes, to wake up to consequences, and to take action. So I am very grateful for the work you're doing and helping to get the message out there. So thank you so much, and thank you for your book, Sicker, Fatter, Poor, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What You Can Do About It. I recommend that everybody pick up a copy and go to sickerfatterpoor.com. Learn how you can make a difference for yourself, your family, and your community. So, Dr. Leonardo Tresenti, thank you so much for your time today. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Bye for now.
Thank you.
And to all of you listening, oh, my gosh, you know, I just want to say that I have looked at this issue for so many years. When I wrote my book, Hormone Heresy, this was what I was discovering to my horror, and especially how it had such long-term consequences to the reproductive health of people. So I do hope everyone will take seriously the effects of exposure and also start implementing the changes if you haven't already. I only use organic skincare range. I only use organic soaps, cleaning products. These are things that we can do in our home to reduce our exposure for ourselves and our family. And I think Dr. Sandy made a really good point. We need to take this further out. We need to bring it into our businesses, into our school environments, into our environments, daycare centers. I mean, you know, wherever we go, we need to make these changes happen because we have so much exposure and we can make a difference. So please start making these changes happen in your life. If your family, start finding the organic foods, replace commercial foods, and don't eat out of tin cans because they are all lined with bisphenol A. And I never accept a receipt when I am at any store. If I do need to have it, I'll have them send it to me as an email, but I never hold that receipt and I never take it and, you know, carry it with me. So these are some practical things you can do, and hope you will start making those changes and letting everyone in your life, in your family, in your community become aware. So if you want to learn more about how to do that, please go to Dr. Tresenti's website, sickerfatterpoor.com, or you can visit his website, which is Leo Tresenti, and that's TRASANDE.com. So that's what it's about, getting empowered with truthful information so we really can make a difference and a change in our world. And until next time, thank you for joining me. I hope that you will come back again. More empowering information next week. And remember, I have another podcast on Progressive Radio Network. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. It is called The Love Code. And that is a show that is truly uplifting, healing, transforming, inspiring, bringing on spiritual teachers, wise elders, people who are incorporating another way to make their world and their life one of peace, love, and happiness. So I hope you'll join me there. And until next time, as always, honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.